You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Unprecedented storms and fires are ravaging communities and destroying lives, all while revealing dynamics in society, politics, and power. What are these risks and revelations, and what needs to be done? We're joined by Steve Matthewman and Naomi Zack. Steve Matthewman is a professor of sociology at the University of Auckland. He's the author of Disasters, Risks, and Revelations. Naomi Zack is a professor of philosophy at the University of Oregon. She's the author of The Ethics of Disaster. Welcome to the Scholars Circle, Steve Matthewman and Naomi Zack. It's great to have you both with us. Both of you have been studying disasters, and both of you have said in your respective work about how disasters reveal something kind of underneath the veil. I thought that's a good place to start. Steve Matthewman, what did you mean when you said that?
I think disasters often reveal social arrangements in their clearest possible light. So they tell us who counts, they tell us what counts, they show us the values of the powerful, if you like. So, I mean, I was just thinking about some of the current debates around Hurricane Harvey as one example of that, and the media as agenda setters here. And in terms of who counts, well, Hurricane Harvey is a terrible thing, and of course we need to be covering it in the media, but at the same time we've got India, Nepal, maybe a third of Bangladesh underwater, 1,200 people plus dead, and probably the indicators I've seen are maybe a fifth of the media coverage. So certainly some people count more than others, and it's also what counts. Hopefully this program will counter the trend, but you know, getting the role of climate change in these so-called natural disasters is somewhat difficult. So I mean, I was looking at media coverage in 2016, for example, of climate change, and it's dropped precipitously in countries like the United States. So there's an organization called Media Matters for America, and they looked at evening newscasts and Sunday shows on ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox News Sunday, and coverage in 2015 was 66% higher. That is to say, in 2016, you know, global warming's not going away, but a 66% drop in coverage. So, you know, some things that are perhaps even of existential importance now are just not being covered. So that's basically what I'm getting at.
So it's also how they're being covered. So for example, they're covering the storms and the fires, by the way, because Los Angeles is on fire.
Sure.
And Oregon is, I understand, got quite a bit of fire, and Montana's on fire.
Yeah.
But are they being covered in a way that people understand the phenomena?
I have a different take on this after starting in about 2005 and making various suggestions, talking to different groups, writing a book, writing articles, etc. I think we have to be very careful about the political appropriation of disaster from either side, because the really pressing aspect of disaster is people die. And the reason people die is there is not adequate preparation. And the reason there's not adequate preparation, if you want to hear something behind or underneath the veil, it's that there's a real existential problem of action, and of action in order to avert a future harm. In other words, everybody starts talking about disaster right after a disaster, especially in a wealthy country, for example, Harvey. But what we lack globally, and this is painfully obvious in parts of the world that are always poor, what we lack is a shared value of preparation. And that's a practical matter. So in a sense, it doesn't really matter whether these disasters are caused by climate change or whether they're completely accidental, or it doesn't matter if they're coincidental or accidental or whatever. The point is people are not prepared for them. And that's why people die in the moment. Now, the other issue of disasters being man-made, human-made, that's obviously true. But that issue is addressed in a moral sense or in an existential sense by good practical preparation, which we don't have. So that's why we not only have disasters, but we have crises, we have emergencies, we have great drama, we have incredible spectacle. Instead of people doing everything they can on a number of different levels to prepare or to better prepare.
Steve, Matthewman, do you agree?
It seemed like we were taking issue on some things, but I would have thought the production of vulnerability is itself political. I would have thought how one prepares or mitigates it are also political issues. I mean, one thing I was thinking of is currently there's a terrible hurricane heading towards the United States, Category 5, Hurricane Irma. If you think about the standard pattern of those types of hurricanes, they go directly over Hispaniola, Cuba, Florida. Haiti is always devastated by these. Cuba typically isn't. And then in America, the poor are. Why not in Cuba? Because there is mitigation plans. And what happens in a very simple terms, and the United Nations regard Cuba as being best practice in this regard, is that you've got days of warning that these things are coming. People are taken out of the danger zone. They're taken to shelters. Things that might blow away, big hazards, are secured. Power, gas, electricity is switched off. And then people are only brought back again when it's safe. If you compare that with something like Katrina, where the poor are people that didn't have access to private motor vehicles were left on their own. So yes, it's a mitigation problem, as has been mentioned, but it's also a question of politics and political will, and again, of who and what counts. So, you know, I think within the sociology of disasters, that's a prominent motif. And certainly take the point that we need to think about how some populations and some people are rendered vulnerable. I certainly take the point that often we wait for the disaster, then say, my goodness, let's not let this happen again. But if we're staying on the topics at hand, which are wildfires and hurricanes, we know in both of those cases that global warming exacerbates both. So in the case of hurricanes, higher sea levels because of thermal expansion of seawater, right? So we're going to get stronger storm surges, more ferocious storms cause higher sea temperatures. That's effectively fuel for hurricanes, and warmer air can hold more moisture. And then
this is correct. I don't disagree with any of this. I'm just making a rhetorical point. And that is that the appropriation of disaster, for, in this case, for good cause, would require a more equitable system for minority populations and poor populations, not only in wealthy countries, but globally as well. And that's fine, but I think that that is harder to bring about. In other words, you're not going to get that kind of a social sea change, if you like, more easily then you can save lives in the moment as disasters occur. And even with those kinds of changes, which don't look very plausible in the current political climate that we're all bathing in, even with those changes, you're still going to have disasters without preparation. Let me just complete this notion of preparation. I think that in well-structured societies, there are three levels of preparation. There is individual or family-based preparation, which involves quite prosaically disaster kits. People can afford disaster kits in the United States. Most people don't have them, and they're stranded and they're helpless for want of flashlights, water, whatever their local disaster demands. That's level one. Level two is community assistance. Most first responders, even in the United States, are not going to be officials, they're going to be neighbors. So people need to know their neighbors, at least know them, and have their neighbors know them, so they'll want to help each other in an emergency. And then the third thing is putting some pressure on different levels of government entities to be prepared. And to some extent, if you compare Harvey with Katrina, the officials do learn at tremendous cost of life, really tragic cost of life, they do learn. So anyway, that's the preparation thing. My second idea is a more of a global idea. And I think everyone would be well served if there was an international disaster corps ready to go anywhere in the world, basically on an all hazards approach. And the way to finance that would be through insurance, with wealthier countries picking up some of the tab for poorer countries. So in other words, in some areas, and actually with the worst disasters, you actually see this more and more, there is simply not local assistance available. So assistance has to come in, and it's a very ad hoc series of arrangements to bring in help from other countries or from the Red Cross or from other governments. What we really need at this point is we need a global disaster corps made up of multidisciplinary professionals and practitioners who can get in the air on huge cargo planes that have some kind of aquatic capability, and helicopters and so forth, and go where the disaster is. But that's not going to happen without some degree of international cooperation. You'd have to set up an international insurance corporation. That's what it would amount to. Everybody would pay premiums, but they wouldn't get the services until an event came up. And probably in the long run, it would be a lot cheaper, because quite a bit is spent on humanitarian aid, and humanitarian aid tends to be ad hoc, and it's not always efficient. So what I'm trying to say is, yes, there are the deeper structural issues that are revealed in disaster. And if you think about it for a minute, if it's true that there are these deeper structural issues of indifference, neglect, and apathy toward the poor and toward minorities, a disaster isn't going to change the minds of those in power concerning those inegalitarian structures. If anything, they're just going to yawn wider as long as it doesn't affect them. But so you have that, and you also have this issue of climate change. The problem with climate change is it's been appropriated as an ideological issue. So on both sides, and it's very hard to make any progress because it's no longer a practical matter of what we should do based on our best information, because the so-called climate change deniers have succeeded in tainting any information pertaining to scientific evidence. So you might call that the truth wars. In other words, I think the truth wars and the inequality wars and the cultural wars are best fought on their own ground. And in terms of dealing with disaster, what we're really lacking, what we could actually fulfill, we could do something about this collectively and individually and in small groups, is preparation. We're lacking preparation. A lot of time is being spent in arguing about causes and arguing about inequality and blame. But really, that doesn't give us the boats when a city is flooded. You know, when Harvey was flooded, the officials didn't have enough boats. And they said, well, we'd have to have 350 boats on hand. We don't have them. We couldn't keep them on hand. Why not? You know, why not? That's a good question. So they appealed to the public, and the public was very good, but there is a more efficient way of doing it. So I'm just riveted. And that's why I wrote that book, Ethics for Disaster. It was after watching what was happening during Katrina. I'm riveted on the fact that whenever something like this happens, it's like, oh my God, who would have thought? What a surprise. You know, of course we're not prepared. Nobody could have imagined such a thing. Well, we know these things are going to happen. Right. And we know they're going to continue to happen.
So Naomi, Zach, let's just let Steve Matthewman respond. Is it really an ideological war on climate change, or do we really need to understand this and get it across to the public?
Well, we absolutely need to understand it. The science isn't ideological. The science is in. It's settled. So the ideology is about what we do about it. And it does involve a strange politics, I think, because, you know, most politics throughout most history has been advocating for the self and your group. It's about getting more recognition and respect. But crucially, it's been about getting more resources as well. Now, we know the problem in countries like the United States and countries like New Zealand, where I am, the carbon footprint of the average citizen is huge. We're in a way over-consuming. So if we've got to be ethical towards the rest of the planet and the rest of planetary life and other populations outside of these privileged enclaves, we do need to consume less. So that is ideological, and that's also practical, and it's political. We've got to do all of those things. I like the idea of the international core in some ways, because I think often, if you think about these climate-related disasters, we used to call them natural disasters, but and sociologists think there are natural hazards. Whether or not it's a natural disaster or not links to issues that we've already talked about, like levels of preparation, mitigation, response, resourcing, things like that. But how natural nature is these days is a question of some concern, isn't it, given anthropogenic climate change and things like that. So I like the international idea in the sense that often the biggest victims of these disasters are not the perpetrators of them. They're not powerfully industrialized countries are hyper-consumers, that they're quite the opposite. And often they're dealing with the legacies of colonialism and things like that anyway, right? I mean, Haiti is a wonderful case in point there. You know, it was the wealthiest country in the Western Hemisphere. Now it's the poorest. And there's an entire colonial legacy, which carries on in neo-colonial forms to this day, that explains that. You know, if you want to see neoliberalism in its purest form, go to Haiti. That's where you'll find it. But, you know, it'd be nice to get some more details on this international corps, because search and rescue search, but they don't rescue. By the time they arrive, you're dead. It's too late. So the first search and rescue teams that came to Haiti were from Finland and places like that. So it gets back to the point that was already made about first responders. The people that will rescue you in disaster are your neighbors, your community members. But actually, I'm a bit more optimistic about the ethical nature of human beings. Complete strangers. There's more than a century of robust empirical evidence from the sociology of disasters, which shows that actually people will even risk their own lives to help anonymous others, to help people they won't know.
People, they're attracted to innocent victims of disaster. They tend to have an aversion to victims of armed conflict. But, you know, I want to push back on the possibility of an international disaster corps, because help from Finland to Haiti took a while to organize. And what I'm talking about is a system of people who could be based throughout the world, who are already getting organized, say, if it was a Katrina-like, an Irma-like event, they would already be prepared to go there, or they might even already be there.
I mean, Cuba already does that. I mean, they're a say that can happen already. I guess the other point I wanted to know about this international corps as well is, you know, I live in New Zealand. In the South Island of New Zealand, we had serious earthquakes in Canterbury in 2010, 2011. We're a wealthy, privileged first world country. We're still building back. This rebuild has been slow, painful, deeply problematic, even with all the resources we've got. I don't know enough about New Orleans to think whether those communities think they've built back better or the same. And I understand a lot of those communities are still dispersed and not back in New Orleans.
There's such a thing as disaster capitalism, which Naomi Klein has written about quite comprehensively. And there are some places where there are enough resources left so that it represents an entrepreneurial opportunity. And lots of money is made in the rebuilding effort. Now, the problem with a country like Haiti is there isn't enough left after one of their disasters for anybody to exploit. So that's purely a question of humanitarian aid. You know, Haiti was pledged something like $39 billion after their earthquake in 2005, but it was all sort of ad hoc and piecemeal, and there's an awful lot of disaster tourism. What I'm talking about is I didn't know that Cuba already did this, but Cuba is a small country with, I'm guessing, limited resources. I mean, this would be a multi-billion dollar enterprise financed by insurance premiums. So in other words, every country would pay its premium regardless of whether or not they had any events needing the disaster corps assistance. And premiums would be paid in lieu of humanitarian aid after a disaster, although that could be done as well. Premiums would be paid for countries that couldn't afford them. So what this does is it takes quite a lot out of the hands of entrepreneurs, disaster capitalists. It cuts out disaster tourism, cut out all the middlemen and women that distribute disaster aid. And this would have to have multiple bases throughout the world, multiple sources of supplies. It might be divided into different regions. There'd be different specialists for different kinds of disasters. So I'm talking about something very different than one country swooping in and helping another country. The recovery is different from the rescue. I mean, what you want from the rescue is you just want to save lives.
One of the things, Naomi, Zach, that you had written about also in that book that we're talking about was about the difference in governments and how certain governments don't even let international help in. How right. would such a structure even function when you're dealing with an authoritarian right. government?
Yeah, Myanmar for a while wasn't letting people in, and then I think they relented. Well, you know, you try to persuade them. Most governments will let people in. The ones that won't let outside aid in, it's a subject for diplomacy. But none of these structures even exist. There is no entity set up at the moment trying to convince governments that are not likely to let people in ahead of the fact to just let them in if something happens. And then the question is, well, actually, how are they going to stop them? Are they going to shoot down rescue aircrafts? I mean, if they're in the middle of a disaster, you know, that's a problem, but that's not the main issue here. I don't think that's the main issue.
It is a side issue. Inside issues do matter too.
Yeah. It is. In other words, it's a problem, but it doesn't really get to the heart of a centrally conceived and run, but locally dispersed disaster rescue corps.
Right. So, and then let's look back at the rebuilding aspect, because this is another element that, and Steve, you brought this up in terms of what's going on in New Zealand specific, but there are issues with power, there are issues with infrastructure, there are issues of doing it in such a way that you're prepared so that it doesn't happen again, and that with that level of destruction, doing things in a more fair, sustainable way. Give us a little bit of feedback in terms of what you've seen in your research.
Well, certainly my research in Christchurch, which is the current research, is in its most preliminary stage, so I can't tell you a lot. But there the feeling is that, you know, there's this maxim, build back better, and everyone thinks, yeah, building back better is a good idea. You know, construction has been such a problem. We've lacked the skilled number of tradespeople to do a build of that level. So the Earthquake Commission is currently reporting something more than 11,000 complaints about substandard building. And anecdotally, I know friends and colleagues that aren't happy with the rebuild of their own house but can't be bothered complaining. They've moved on. Some of them have left the country even. You know, they're working in North America now and other places. So it's a massive challenge. Some of the big issues are the disconnect between top-down government imperatives and local priorities. Some of the latest polls I've seen have shown that something about 70% dissatisfaction with the recovery priorities. And, you know, a really, really difficult thing to say, and we might say about New Orleans as well as Christchurch, is, you know, should they be there? So the local iwi, local Māori, Ngāi Tahu had always warned European settlers about building in a swamp. It's a floodplain, right, basically. And you now think about the issues we were talking about earlier, like climate change. You know they're going to be more vulnerable and more at risk. So you need to think very smartly about how you build in green infrastructure, how you do build back better. You know, there are red zoned areas in Christchurch, so there are certain places where they're not going to be built back. But at the moment, there's a deep dissatisfaction with partly the slowness of the rebuild. And I guess that was why I was talking about this international corps. I think I understand it a bit more now. It's about rescuing, saving lives, because actually building, rebuilding cities, communities, you know, that takes years. So that is difficult. But because it is slow, I mean, there are still prospects. One of the things I noticed in Christchurch is that local government and national government were quite good at funding NGOs, community organizations like Greening the Rubble, Gap Filler, and they achieved this global eminence in something called temporary or transitional urbanism, which is, you know, the way in which public life is enhanced by, you know, galleries, community gardens, performance areas, whatever it may be. And I guess the question I'm trying to ask is, what would happen if you let the people in to talk about more enduring urban structures, including infrastructure and electrical power provision and things like that? So I mean, it's a very rare opportunity to rebuild a modern city. I mean, it's only the second time we've had it in this country.
Steve, I'd like to ask you a question about rebuilding. You know, Harvey, Houston, it's a city that sprawled on what was previously very spongy ground. The city itself is something like 600 square miles, the urban area. And the reason there was so much flooding is they've covered it over with concrete. So the water can't be, you see what I'm saying? So the question is, how do you persuade people, governments, individuals, developers, how do you persuade them not to rebuild in areas that are going to just lead to the same thing the next time? How do you change that short-sighted drive to do it all over again to make money?
I think what you actually have to have is really strong, robust legislation, because I've read some of the stuff on Harvey as well, saying that urban sprawl is a huge problem there. The siting is a problem. Concretization is a problem. And that's a massive problem all over the world, actually, channeling water, stopping it absorbing into the ground. But I've also heard there that poor or non-existing zoning laws and some pretty poor insurance practices as well compound it. So I think this is where you really need the state and government to be wrong and actually have very firm legislation so that you don't let people build in floodplains and that you do compel catastrophic insurance, flood insurance things.
In the United States, Trump just allowed to lapse a requirement that new construction take some kind of disaster mitigation into account. So that's no longer there. And we don't have, I mean, in the present political climate, we don't really have a legislature, at least on a federal level, that seems to have a will to require disaster mitigation. I don't think it can happen. I mean, do you think that when you say government, do you mean more local government?
Specifically national government, so what you'd call federal government. But I think local and regional governments have to do this as well. But, you know, I think this may be compelled on governments in all forms anyway, because you can't afford to keep rebuilding Houston, New Orleans, New York, and add this to the list. So I was trying to do some preparation for this talk and look at some of the scientific literature on likelihood of flood events in places like the US. And only this year, there was an article in Environmental Research Letters saying that they would anticipate a 40-fold increase in 1-in-100-year flood events in coastal US regions by 2050. So, you know, states are going to run out of the money and the capacity and the ability to keep rebuilding if they don't do this. The old adage is true, prevention is better than cure. So I think, in a way, reality, world events will force this upon people to do it, because you simply won't be able to keep building back from destruction.
If we're living in an era of what might be somewhat dysfunctional national government in areas like this, maybe it's going to fall to local government. So some states are much more proactive than other states in terms of emissions controls, in terms of building codes. And we might be seeing an uneven local type of preparation or not.
I can see individual cities and some in the states are already starting to take a lead as environmental champions, as best practice builders and mitigators. So just to get back to what we really do, I mean, I think the two giant elephants in the room, well, one we've exposed and it's climate change. The other one is, to get back to Naomi's points about, you know, populations being rendered vulnerable, and that's the historically unparalleled wealth disparities we face. So the two big things we've got to get to work on is reducing CO2 emissions and redistributing wealth.
Thank you both, Naomi Zack and Steve Matthewman, for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. It's been a great joy to host you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure.
Steve Matthewman is a professor of sociology at the University of Auckland. He's the author of Disasters, Risks, and Revelations. Naomi Zack is a professor of philosophy at the University of Oregon. She's the author of The Ethics of Disaster.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.